From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The acclaimed historian Taylor Branch has just published a story that examines the history of the NCAA and raises some critical questions about the structure of college sports. The piece appears in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine, and it's receiving a lot of attention. In it, Branch takes on the scandals involving money in college athletics, but he makes the case for actually paying college athletes. Branch says in the story that the two principles which the NCAA uses to justify its existence, the principles of amateurism and the student-athlete, have become cynical hoaxes. Legalistic confections, he calls them, used by universities to exploit the skill and fame of young athletes. Today in the program, Taylor Branch will join us to make his case and defend his argument after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The latest project for the acclaimed historian Taylor Branch is a full-blown expose on the structure of college sports. Branch's story appears in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine, and in it he examines the relationship between athletics and academic institutions. A good part of the story, though, is a critical history of the NCAA, the association that governs most of college sports. The piece appears in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine. It's receiving a lot of attention. It's been called a watershed. The sports journalist Frank DeFord said it was the most important article ever written about college sports. The piece is generating discussion because while taking on the business side of college athletics and addressing the many scandals involving athletes and money, Branch actually recommends paying these athletes. He takes on the principles that he says the NCAA uses to justify its existence, among them the concept of amateurism and the idea of the student-athlete. After unraveling their history, Branch concludes that these principles have become cynical hoaxes used to exploit the skill and the fame of young athletes. Today in the program, Taylor Branch is joining us to make his case and to defend his argument. We invite you to join the conversation with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Taylor Branch is the author of a three-volume history of the civil rights movement called America in the King Years. It earned him a Pulitzer Prize. His article, The Shame of College Sports, appears in the October issue of The Atlantic. His complete investigation into college sports and the NCAA, we should say, is now available as an e-book, and we'll give you more details about that as we go along. Today in the program, Taylor Branch is joining us from a studio at the Baltimore Sun. And Taylor Branch, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Nice to be here.
Well, I guess the most obvious first question is just what is it that got you, but you know, an acclaimed historian, interested in this issue in the first place?
Well, my children are teasing me about that now. I don't think I had any better sense. I went to my friends in The Atlantic and said that I wanted to do a magazine piece on shorter term before I disappear into my next history book. They asked me what topics I was interested in. I mentioned a number in politics. They asked me if there were any others. I said I'd always been curious about why the NCAA scandals kept revolving and revolving and never getting anywhere. And as a passing sports fan, I was interested in that. And they said, that's what you should do, because that would be surprising. And I said, well, I don't know anything about it. And they said, all the better. Go see what you find out. And I stumbled into quite a hornet's nest.
You did. I guess your kids have been kidding you about the fact that you've published a Pulitzer Prize-winning series, and now you're getting so much attention for this.
I know, and they're saying you finally hit on a worthwhile subject that people care about after 25 years on the civil rights movement and race relations.
Well, but isn't that true in some respects? I mean, all kinds of people have this, yourself included, this affection for sports. Many of us college sports, and we're drawn to the subject. And as you say, people are talking a lot about the ideas you raise in this piece.
Yes, I was surprised. I'm still surprised. I mean, to have an ebook out less than 2 weeks after the original article and to be required to learn Twitter in order just to follow what's going on, it's really kind of amazing. I'm stupefied. But in another sense, it's not surprising to see that reactions have divided people. People have determined that they're not sure exactly what they think. Political liberals and reformers originally went in saying they wanted just to drain all the money out and return the university to Socrates, or on the other hand, to stop the exploitation of poor African-American athletes. While conservative pundits, George Will just wrote me a note saying that he was all for this. He wanted to put the NCAA in the axis of evil because it exploits these players. But then, you know, David Brooks said in the New York Times Friday that there are higher morals than the marketplace, yeah, which normally governs conservatives. So people's ideas about this subject are really jumbled once you start opening it up and thinking about it.
I want to begin with an image that actually this is how you begin your story, the Atlantic piece, and it takes place, I think it was 10 years ago, features a guy named Sonny Vaccaro. And he, in this, the way you frame the story, he's speaking to members of this commission charged with, I guess, stripping the commercialism out of college sports. Set this up for us, if you would, because it kind of embodies, as you say, how this story it plays out, but also kind of some brutal honesty that's involved here.
Absolutely. Sonny Vaccaro was the chief impresario of commercialism in modern college sports and pro sports, too. He signed Michael Jordan to Michael Jordan's first shoe contract and then became the director of advertising and sports commerce at both Adidas and Nike, in addition to Reebok. So he was like the king of college sports, and he's a witness before the Knight Foundation Commission reform. And it was a very august body, college presidents, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, a couple of the head of the NCAA. And they were kind of offended by him because they thought he personified the commercialism that these reformers were trying to restrain. And the president of Penn State asking point blank, why should any university become an advertising medium for your industry, the shoe industry?
Yeah.
And it was said in a kind of challenging tone. And Sonny Vaccaro said, they shouldn't, sir. That's what I've been trying to tell you. I can only offer the money, but you will take it. And you have sold your souls, and not a single one of you will walk away from this money. And it was, according to people who were there, a moment that silenced the whole room with its brutal honesty. And actually, Sonny Vaccaro was quite cheerful about it. He said he was just stating the facts of the world. But William Friday, who was my dear university president when I was at North Carolina 40 years ago, was the chair of that commission. And he said he would never forget it, that there was a silence in the room because Sonny Vaccaro was stating a truth that they didn't really want to address. They thought they were the solution to the problem, and he's telling them, you're the problem yourself right there. You're the one pursuing the money.
Mm. True then, you say. True now, this problem. Lay it out for us, if you would. Corporations are offering this money so they can basically make money off the popularity of university athletics, which is a multi-billion dollar
yes,
proposition
definitely,
now?
Yes, definitely multi-billion. I mean, the Southeastern Conference alone, down in the South, the football-crazed Southeastern Conference generated $1 billion in athletic revenue in 2010. It was the first conference to do that. The Big Ten was $905 million. The University of Texas just signed a $300 million contract for its own college sports network. So, yes, this is multi-billions of dollars. The March Madness basketball tournament alone every year for 1 month's work, CBS pays directly to the NCAA $771 million for running that tournament. That's 95% of the NCAA's income. So, yes, it is big money. And on top of the broadcast revenue and all of the ticket revenue, you'd also have shoe contracts and sponsorship deals, like not only with Adidas and Nike, but Under Armour. And Under Armour has a deal with Auburn University that pays it $10.6 million a year. And Cam Newton, the Auburn quarterback last year, who was under investigation, at the same time he's under investigation for allegedly taking favors under the table, He is required by the NCAA and Auburn to wear 15 Under Armour logos on his uniform while he's playing, four on his helmet, one on each wristband, two on his shoes, and so forth. So it's a very, very commercialized business.
Put the United States in perspective for all of this, because you say the U.S. is the only country in the world that hosts big-time sports at a university setting.
We are the only university in the world, and it's largely by historical accident that at the time sports were being popularized and to some degree invented. I mean, football was invented here. Basketball was invented. Football was adapted from rugby. Yeah. Baseball was adapted from British rounders. It was after the Civil War, and it was a craze in the universities, mostly in the elite Ivy League schools that would become the Ivy League. At the same time, the European universities were colonizing the world. We didn't colonize the world, but we thought toughening and the idealism of amateurism, which was motivating the colonies and the revival of the Olympics, helped create this institution of highly popular, highly commercial, always controversial college sports in our colleges alone. And we're still the only schools. What's changed is that they originated under the control of the students who scheduled their own games and didn't even have any coaches. Yeah. They didn't get paid coaches until the 20th century. But now the adults have taken it over, and our courts have steadily ruled that when adults are pursuing their interests, the coaches, the institutions themselves, the free market should reign, and the only place that the free market is restrained by collusion is when it comes to paying the players.
It seems like the essence of what this story is about is our impressions, really myths. It's that term you actually use in the piece, about what it means to play as an amateur, what even that term has come to mean overall.
I agree. I mean, I think we all have jumbled emotions, and I had them too. I confess in the article. I hope it comes through. I really hoped to purify amateurism myself here. I think most people, there's something about amateurism that it's our notion of youth, of innocence, of a time when we could learn, when we weren't worried about the cares of the everyday world. Part of the reason people love sports is because you don't have to think too much. It's an escape from thinking. You can just have fun, and the rules are clear, and it's free of all the controversy. But amateurism, when you think about it, is pretty hard to define. Yeah. It's best an aspiration that you may have for yourself, but it doesn't look very good when you impose it on someone else. And it usually involves pretty jumbled emotions of youth and innocence. I mean, after all, we don't want to see amateurish performances when we turn in a college basketball or football game. We want them to look like they are pros and gifted and skilled. There's just something about the idea of money that makes these students vulnerable to be exploited.
Mm. How do you describe? Because this is where it gets, where you have to be careful, and you are clearly in the piece, how you describe the predicament of college athletes. They're not slaves. I mean, you take that term, as you say in the piece, very seriously. But you do say that the analogy may not be that far off. I mean, as you write, you do catch the whiff of the plantation, you say, when you survey the scene.
I do. A lot of people have attacked me for even mentioning the phrase slavery, and I did say they're not slaves. Let's be careful. They're certainly not. They're glorified, and they're on our college campuses. However, for all of its horrors, slavery was debated at great length and put into state laws by votes in enormous detail. It was a law. I have a code book from Georgia in the 90s, as part of my research into racial history and Dr. King. Half the laws had to do with slavery and things related to slavery. And they were published they were debated and published in public forums. The NCAA's amateurism rules have the same effect, but they are nowhere in law. You couldn't write a law to deprive people of this income. Mm. It's all done by collusion and by custom, and in some senses, in that way, it's less honest than slavery. But the plantation basically means, and colonialism, that we, a lot of us think that we're doing this for the own, for the good of these players, that we're doing them a favor by denying them the opportunity to earn money. And in that sense, the more you look at it, the more exploitive it becomes.
I want to talk more about the ideals and myths that inspired amateurism in college sports, because you take us there in the piece. This is where you're good. Taylor Branch is an historian. You take us to the late 19th century. Intellectuals, you say, kind of believed that sports, and you talked a little bit about this before, but this was simulating the impending age of the Darwinian struggle. And then there's this myth that the NCAA then appears to civilize what had become something violent and brutal.
Well, the game was violent and brutal in colorful and amusing ways at the end of the 19th century. After all, the players didn't wear helmets.
Right.
Princeton was famous because the Princeton students grew their hair long and coiled their hair on the side of their heads in what they called a chrysanthemum hairdo that was all they wanted for helmets in the 1890s. A lot of people were getting hurt and crippled, as you might imagine. John L. Sullivan, the bare-knuckled heavyweight championship, said he wouldn't dare get in a football game, that it was murderous, that at least he could see his opponent in the ring, whereas early football was really quite brutal. They didn't have a forward pass. One of the good things about the NCAA in 1906, it was really created as a complicated story by President Theodore Roosevelt, who in part was frustrated that Harvard was always losing to Yale, and, and Yale was in charge of the rules.
Yeah.
And he created the NCAA and took the rules away from Yale and installed the Harvard coach. But one of the first things that it did was to introduce the forward pass.
Yeah.
And in that era, it was hard to do so because people thought the forward pass was cowardly. To throw the ball in the air and actually get free yardage was cowardly relative to, you know, gutting it out and putting your chrysanthemum hairdo
right.
In the middle of one of these scrums.
Right.
So it really was the social Darwinist era. And when people tried to reform football or even abolish football at Harvard, great intellectuals, George Santayana and Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, said, no, all these sports injuries are worth it because this is a small price to pay to breed a race worthy of governing the world. So sports did kind of come out of this social Darwinist era, at least so far as football is concerned.
Well, so you talked about the beginnings then of the NCAA. In its first decades, though, we should point out, didn't have much power, that group.
Zero power.
Yeah.
I had thought this was one of my first kind of jaw-dropping discoveries. I thought the NCAA would have been established in law and come down to us from on high long ago and had all this full-blown power, and that it was the rise of money that may have eroded that power. Actually, the NCAA didn't have any power for a long time. Sports were very commercial. The University of Pittsburgh freshman players went publicly on strike in 1939 because the upperclassmen were getting paid more. This is not anything new. The NCAA didn't have the power since it was simply an association of the colleges, and the colleges ran it, and they were all competitive, and they all preferred to wink at what they were doing. And it was an amazing historical accident in 1951 that the NCAA first got its power because people believed that television was going to kill college sports. to me, what a colossal irony that people thought it was going to kill college sports, because every expert was saying if the fans can see the games at home for free, nobody's going to buy tickets anymore. And so the founder of the modern NCAA, Walter Byers, whom I'd never heard of, who's a genius, he convinced all of the colleges to allow the NCAA to regulate college sports and college football on television in order to save it from extinction. And
Taylor Branch, let me back up there, though. Walter, say something more about Walter Byers. He is this, as you say, genius, but surprising character. You wouldn't think this guy would completely have crafted the structure of the college sports that we've come to know now. And he's a terrific character, I have to say.
He is a great character. I mean, the NCAA was desperate. They had tried. They had these amateur rules, and the colleges weren't paying any attention to them. to the point that right after World War II, they enacted something called the Sanity Code, saying we have to have some sanity if these schools, we have to have some rules as schools are paying athletes off the books. They have no-show jobs at Hollywood studios. I mean, it was ridiculous. We have a sanity code, and the colleges basically laughed it off and said, no, we're not going to do it. And then they hired Walter Byers, who was a young guy. He was a college dropout himself, ironically. He didn't finish college. He was less than 30 years old. He was a journalist. But he saw that the scandals were getting so bad that there was a crisis over the University of Kentucky basketball team where its players were involved in point-shaving scandals with gangsters. And he essentially pushed through the first significant sanctions saying you can't do this sort of thing and I'm going to enforce it. And simultaneously, he said, television, these newfangled televisions are going to ruin college sports if you don't let me regulate it. And he pushed it through, and it became so that he personally and the NCAA negotiated every professional football television contract, a college football contract with a television network from 1952 until 1984 for 30 years. And all the money went through them. That's where the fabled game of the week came. He would only allow one game each week to be broadcast in the entire country. And that was the basis of the modern NCAA. But
It crafted our weekend.
It absolutely crafted our weekend. And all the money went through him, and he doled it out. The NCAA has 1,000 members. Very few of them actually contributed any of the revenue, the big football schools. And he gave money to every school. And to this day, every school member school gets a check from the NCAA every year. But that's part of its problem. It is stretched too thin. Mm-hmm. Most of these schools don't have anything in common with one another. The big football schools revolted in the 1980s, saying, we want to broadcast our own TV games. We want to be on TV every week, and we don't want our money to run through the NCAA. And they went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court agreed and basically expelled the NCAA. It gets no revenue out of televised college football and hasn't for 30 years. And that really, in some respects, is the beginning of the end, because all those big football schools, to some degree, still resent the NCAA and the power that it has over them. It also makes the NCAA lopsided in that it gets all of its revenue from March Madness basketball, none from football. It has a blatant, obvious conflict of interest in trying to enforce amateurism rules, because it's biting the hand that feeds it if it enforces it in basketball and not in football. And basically, it can't really enforce any rules at all, which is why the penalties in the modern age are simply things like they make you give back a trophy, or they vacate some of your wins from the past, or they suspend the players. But they don't do anything that gets in the way of the institutional revenue streams of these schools.
The result of that challenge in the 80s by college football programs, it's interesting. It's the result of that seems to be that it freed these schools to go into the open market and sell their sports programs. And that seems to be where it became even more and more commercial.
Absolutely. There had always been money around it.
Yeah.
But the money was informal. A lot of times it was done by the boosters. I was surprised to discover that Harvard Stadium was built in 1903 without a nickel from Harvard. It was all done by alumni. So that's how this thing was done. It didn't have any institutional money. But once the TV era came and you started pumping in the television revenues on top of the broadcast revenues in the modern age of sports, there's enormous money involved. And from that 1984 decision, Regents v. the NCAA, the lead plaintiffs were the University of Georgia and the University of Oklahoma, but they were suing on behalf of all of the big football schools. Essentially, the courts have ruled that where adults are involved, you can't limit the amount of money they make. You can't limit the amount of money a coach makes. the NCAA actually tried to restrain the salaries of assistant coaches,
right,
who banded together, sued the NCAA, won a $50 million judgment, and now we have assistant coaches who are making more than $1 million a year. So the only place that there are restraints on the market of college sports are the players.
Talk about your experience going to what they call the Iron Bowl down south, the annual game against the Auburn Tigers and the Alabama Crimson Tide. You call it being in the throbbing heart of college sports.
It was amazing. Now, I should say, I grew up in Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta, and I was very nearly a college athlete myself. I was recruited and almost signed a football scholarship in 1964. Instead, I went to North Carolina and did not play sports. But I had been inside. I'd been recruited. I'd been in locker rooms 50 years ago, and it was crazy back then. But to go to the Iron Bowl between Alabama, which was the reigning national champion, and Auburn, which was undefeated, and in the midst of this great Cam Newton scandal, its star quarterback, was quite an experience for me. I drove over from my mother's house in Atlanta before dawn, and the radio was going nuts and already about the game. And there was one guy, I'll never forget, I put it in the article. He came on and said he had been up all night and couldn't go to sleep because he had been thinking about the coin toss for who's going to kick off. And this is before sunrise on the day of the game. And I went into the Bear Bryant Museum, and it was an amazing experience. And then after the game, which was very, very exciting, Alabama went way out ahead, and then Cam Newton led Auburn back to win in a thrilling game. People were numb, and I wandered out into the parking lot where there were acres and acres of RVs down there. People had come to tailgate days ahead of the game, and to my amazement, there were a lot of people there who had come and tailgated for days and didn't even have tickets to the game. They were just out in the parking lot. So I started asking them, why wouldn't you? And they had these big flat screen satellite TVs that were hooked up. Why didn't you just stay home and watch it on TV? And they looked at me like I was crazy for asking the question, that if I didn't understand why it was worth sacrificing half their work week to be there just so they could hear the stadium, you know, half a mile away or however far away, that I wasn't worth talking to. So this really is an amazing, has an amazing hold on the psyche of a lot of people.
Well, and you say in that case, and I expect many others, of course, the NCAA bends toward public demand, and public demand is really powerful.
Public demand is powerful, and in talking with my dear friend William Friday and many other college presidents and others, they acknowledge right up front that many university presidents and provosts are frightened of the market power, and they know that if they interfere too much with this, that they can imperil their jobs. And a couple of them even told me, look, I benefit from this because my trustees at this university know that if they're paying their football and basketball coaches $2 or $3 million a year, it would be embarrassing to pay the president of the university only $200,000 or $400,000. So they're paying me $1 million. So people, the money from this sports, where adults are concerned, flows everywhere, and it distorts people's judgment.
And you say, I want to get to the critical points of the piece, which the idea of what you do about all of this. Now you've got this Byzantine kind of structure in sports. I'm not sure if there's any way to uncouple the idea of money in sports at this point, certainly in college, although some are suggesting there may be some way. But you say all of this success. And just talk about the March Madness basketball. You mentioned $771 million, as you said, for the television rights just in 2011. And you say all of this is built on the backs of unpaid labor. It depends on these young people doing what is essentially, you say, this is volunteer work.
Yes, and in the case of basketball, it's volunteer work by a very small number of people, which is why it can really concentrate the system and how it works in a moment. And there was one that I mentioned where there was a terrible fear that the players on one team, if they made the NCAA final, were going to dress and then refuse to walk out at midcourt for tip-off. And what was at stake then? Well, the entire NCAA budget, national obsession, a whole college audience, and thousands of livelihoods. And it all depends on 10 college students, five on each side, walking out into a game, or really five, because if one team doesn't show up, the game is crippled. So it really is quite a remarkable structure. And the question is, what to do about it, what to make it fairer. I think it's coming apart anyway. I'm raising objections of principle that I think you can discover once you start examining it. But it's coming apart anyway. It's under attack in the courts. If there's a college football playoff, which there will be, it won't be run by the NCAA, and it's very likely that the schools and the conferences, the super conferences, that's what all this musical chairs is about, is a prelude to a national football playoff. And if they have one without the NCAA, those same schools can very easily say, well, we want to have the national basketball playoff too, and the NCAA can kiss its $771 million goodbye. So the structure of this is already threatened and very precarious.
Taylor Branch is with us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. His investigation of college sports and the NCAA appears in the October issue of The Atlantic and in an e-book. We'll give you a link to that if you go to our website at kuer.org. You can join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the big business of college sports. Over the years, there have been a number of scandals involving student-athletes taking money under the table. But the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch says the real scandal is the structure of college sports itself, where these young athletes make billions of dollars for the universities and for private companies, and yet they get nothing for themselves, really. Branch has written an article in The Atlantic magazine that explores the story. He's with us today to make his case and to defend his argument. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Seth Davis is also joining us on the program today. He challenges some of the contentions in Taylor Branch's reporting, and so I want to get him involved in the conversation as well. He writes for Sports Illustrated. He's a college basketball analyst for CBS Sports. You can find a link to his rebuttal of Taylor Branch's investigation on our website at kuer.org. And he's joining us today. Seth Davis is from a studio in Norwalk, Connecticut. And Seth Davis, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. And Taylor, it's great to meet you over the airwaves as opposed to Twitter.
Yes, thank you, Doug. Thank you, Seth.
Well, let me, I guess I want to jump in. Seth Davis, I want to hear from you first of all. We should say, as you do in your sort of rebuttal piece, that Taylor Branch's concerns are serious, but they're not really. I mean, you've heard the piece been described as a watershed, and now this is critical. But you say it's great, but it's not exactly new, that we've been hearing these kinds of concerns before.
Well, it is a great article, and I happen to be a graduate of Duke University, so for me to say anything nice about a North Carolina graduate is not easy.
I appreciate that. That is something.
It's the ultimate expression of respect, as only a member of the rivalry can know. It is a great article, and I encourage all of your listeners to read this story. I've covered this sport for college sports for more than 20 years, and I learned a great deal about the history of the NCAA and all the legal meanderings that brought us to this point. My main contention with the article is the main contention of the article, and Doug, you just repeated the word that I took such exception with, and that is the word nothing. It's this argument that these college athletes earn all these millions and billions of dollars for the universities, and they earn, quote, nothing for themselves. As the old saying goes, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. I submit that is indisputably, factually untrue to say that they get nothing. Now, do you want to say that they should get more? They're not fairly compensated for what they do? Let's have that debate. But to say that they get nothing when they get free tuition, which for any parent in America like myself trying to save for their child's college education is a significant financial benefit if you just stop there. They also get room and board and housing. They get three square meals a day. They get textbooks, they get academic counseling, academic tutoring. And if you want to roll your eyes and say, well, they're not really students and they're not really pursuing their education, well, let's talk about what they get for their chosen craft in athletics. They get the best teaching and coaching that money can buy. They get practice facilities, they get strength and conditioning work, they get hours spent in front of film with professional coaches breaking down their performance. They get real live game experiences like the Auburn-Alabama football game in front of a big crowd. And by the way, they get a huge marketing opportunity that money can't buy to play on national television. So I think that athletes get a great deal. And to say that they have that they're getting nothing, I just think is factually untrue.
Taylor Branch, respond to that if you would, because you do take on this question. I mean, it's not as if you don't acknowledge the contention that, look, they're getting a scholarship, but you call that self-serving in your piece.
Well, certainly I write a lot about scholarships. It was actually a watershed when the NCAA started authorizing scholarships, and the AAU, which ran the Olympics, said, you've abandoned professionalism, you're impure. Olympic athletes won't have scholarships or anything like it. Yes, scholarships are a benefit. However, scholarships are limited in the sense that the NCAA forbids players from getting anything other than these in-kind payments at the university, including you can't sell your own jersey if you're A.J. Green. It limits by collusion and calls dirty and exploitative any income that that regular employees everywhere else in America are and of right ought to be fully entitled to pursue. There's no other enterprise where that has this imposed kind of limits on what you can argue. I say that to say that a scholarship is sufficient and that you don't need any further income is like telling a worker in any industry that if you've got health insurance, you don't deserve or shouldn't have a salary. Sure, it is true that a lot of college athletes who get scholarships couldn't get more money from the university, even if the amateur rules were abolished, because their sports don't earn money. I acknowledge that, but that's not true for the sports that are really generating all the surplus that we're talking about here and that drives these sports. And the only way those athletes are prevented from bargaining for salaries is because the NCAA, without sanction of law, forbids it.
I want to read an email comes from Park City. Ori writes, all of this leaves out the fact, which is getting at what you guys are talking about. He said it leaves out the fact that these athletes are ostensibly getting an education, which for someone in Florida who goes to Michigan equates to more than $50,000 a year, $200,000 for a four-year scholarship. But Ori writes, does anyone believe that if athletes got paid a few extra dollars a month to buy pizza, that certain star players wouldn't still be looking for more? Where does it stop? Taylor Branch and Seth Davis, you first. I guess, Seth Davis, to you, how do you respond to that idea?
Well, I guess I go back to sort of taking exception to the underlying presence of Taylor's argument. I mean, his whole argument is framed around the fact that they are being denied rights. He's an esteemed civil rights historian, and it seems to me that this is, in his eyes, a civil rights issue. And I'm just, I think that's indisputably untrue. Any college athlete in any sport has the right to pursue money on the basis of his or her athleticism. It's called being a professional. If you are a basketball player, you don't have to play college sports. Now, if you're a freshman, you can't play in the NBA in the United States, but there are plenty of leagues around the world that take young basketball players. There was a basketball player from Southern California, didn't even want to be a senior in high school. He turned professional, went to Israel for a year, went to Japan for the following year, and in this past draft was a second-round pick. Another player, Brandon Jennings, now with the Milwaukee Bucks, did not qualify academically at the University of Arizona. What does he do? He went to Italy, and he played professionally for a year and became a lottery pick in the NBA. These athletes have options, and for people to invoke the capitalist free market, which I'm all for that, to say that that doesn't apply here, to me, that's not being applied fairly, because what you're saying is, you know, they're not good enough to go out and make money based on their athletic ability. Therefore, it's the job of the universities, which are losing tons of money, which I hope we'll get into in a little bit. The vast majority of universities in this country and in the NCAA, even the most prominent, lose money on athletics because their football and men's basketball teams are funding all of these other sports. So if you want to talk about the fair market, are you going to pay the third string safety the same money as the first string quarterback? That's not a fair market. So this is an amateur enterprise. It is a flawed enterprise. I actually think the NCAA needs to update its scholarship model to be able to give the athletes a bigger piece of the pie. I'm perfectly willing to have that discussion. But to say that, you know, they're being denied their competitive rights in the marketplace, again, I just submit that that's factually incorrect.
No, it's not. I'm sorry. I've got to step in here. You're saying this is an amateur enterprise. That is the question. What makes it an amateur enterprise? Why can't Auburn and a player bargain for a salary like any other enterprise that generates lots of money? Only because the NCAA imposes this, by collusion, this restraint on the market. I mean, what other market in the United States for electricians or television or sports reporters would you want to set the terms of people's bargaining? It is not a free market if you say that they generate lots of money, but they are foreclosed from even bargaining for any of it at that market. Where does that right come from?
But Seth, my only question then, Telly, would be, how are you defining the market? You seem to have a relatively limited view of the market that only exists on college campuses. When I think of a free market, I think of a globe of a market. Nobody is forcing these athletes to pursue their education, to abide by the terms of a scholarship, and to forego their ability to make money based on their athletic ability alone. So that if they want to pursue that, wouldn't you agree that they have the right to pursue that outside of the college campus?
That was the argument that the Supreme Court rejected in the Regents case, when the NCAA said that if the colleges want to make more money, they can go somewhere else than in the restricted environment of NCAA television football. The court said, if you're going to set up a market, you got to play by American rules, and freed these schools to go out and sell their. It didn't tell them you have to go to the out of the United States or start a different sports league. It said the NCAA needs to get out of your way and have a free market. And the same thing happened when they tried to limit the coaches. It only has survived so far, and it hadn't even been challenged in the courts yet, for the players. You can't tell somebody if they're in a market that is functioning and existing that they have a right to go to another country. You have to give a good competitive justification for why you are building a cartel structure that tells them they can't bargain for something that is a clearly functioning market in which they are playing a critical role, and yet you are setting the terms for it. You don't do that anywhere else in our society.
Seth Davis, I wanted to get your reaction to Taylor Branch's view of the NCAA. In particular, one particular point he talks about is that the idea of being a student athlete in many ways wasn't based on any noble ideal, or it may have had something like that to do with it, but it was kind of a dodge. It was a shield to get around paying disability benefits. I mean, not just to that particular story, but to the idea that the structure within the NCAA, do you believe that there are elements that do exploit student athletes?
Well, I don't think there's much noble about the enterprise, to be honest. And when I talk about that, sure, that's something that Taylor and I can agree on. This is definitely big business. Right now, the way that the NCAA is set up and the way that the legal structure is set up, the athletes are not employees of the university. So, you know, Taylor keeps talking about the coaches and the administrators and the universities. You know, philosophy professors are employees of the universities. Philosophy students are not, even though some of them may be on scholarship. You know, a lot of English departments make more money for their universities than other disciplines inside that university. So right now, that's where the distinction is being made. So, you mentioned the Regents case, but the Regents case, my understanding, is agreed in part with the NCAA's current tax status as a nonprofit corporation. A nonprofit corporation under the 501c3 article in the IRS code, they pay their employees, but there are certain standards that you have to meet. And the reason why the NCAA has that classification is because they are bringing to bear the argument that playing athletics is part of education, that there is an educational value to play sports. Taylor keeps mentioning that the United States is the only country that does this. Well, thank God. College sports is beautiful. And I really think that part of the differing perspectives, both legitimate, I think, that Taylor and I bring to this, like I said, I've been covering college sports for more than 20 years. When a lot of people think about college sports, they think about Cam Newton. They think about the Final Four. They think about, the bowl, the football bowls and the NCAA tournament and all that. The reality is college sports in America is over 1,000 universities giving literally hundreds of thousands of young men and women the opportunity to participate in sports. And I am not going to lose sleep over the fact that Cam Newton, poor Cam Newton, who was only the first pick in the NFL draft, had to wear all these logos and not make any money from Under Armour when he's wearing these logos on national television playing in this incredible experience. So I'm happy to let a lot of these questions play themselves out on the court. Taylor uses the word collusion. That has not been legally found yet. It may be found in the future. It hasn't been the case yet, but I'm just asking for us to, number one, let's base our arguments and perspectives in fact, and then keep everything in context within the realm of the entire enterprise.
Well, I think that's fair, but I just think on its face, I would like to ask Seth, you've got an enormous amount of money being generated. You have lots of valuable players, and I'm not talking just about Cam Newton. I'm talking about the slogging guard who starts for the Clemson football team. They're generating lots and lots of money. Something is keeping either the player from being allowed to bargain for a portion of his worth, and the college from offering it. And I want to know, if it's not collusion, what else is it? It's certainly not a law. And there's nothing about nonprofits that says that you have to be amateur. Plenty of nonprofit organizations pay their employees lots of money. Universities have lots of employees other than the professors, including students who are teaching assistants and bookstore cashiers. But only these athletes. For some reason, you have a gigantic market with a disconnect in it, and the disconnect, I submit, is because of the universities have banded together through the NCAA and colluded to put this form of the market off limits. And I don't think it's going to survive much longer.
Well, I guess my question in response to your question would then be, why are you consistently citing the money that is coming in to the guard at Clemson, but you're not talking about what the guard at Clemson costs Clemson? There is a cost involved in these sports, and these schools, Doug, they're all less than 10% of schools at the top of the NCAA are running a profit in athletics. Athletics is a huge loss leader. So my question to Taylor Branch is, why are these schools involved in this pernicious collusion and this borderline enslavement and illegality and immorality? Why are they doing this if they're losing money? That was the question I was hoping you would answer.
All right, hold that thought, because I want to get to this idea, the idea of the profit and loss structure of college sports, which Seth Davis takes on. Taylor Branch, I want you to respond to that. But we have to take a quick break, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUWR and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the sports journalist Seth Davis and the historian Taylor Branch. We're talking about Branch's article in the October issue of The Atlantic, talking about the structure and the history of college athletics. And so let's jump back in there. Taylor Branch, Seth Davis says in his piece that your piece sort of ignores the profit and loss structure of college sports. He says, look, forget the idea that amateurism is a noble ideal. He says that from a business standpoint, professionalizing college sports makes no business sense because it's not that great a business. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, it's already professionalized for everybody except the athletes. The coaches, the television networks, the institutions, everything else. I mean, it's a gigantic business. I think we're all agreed on that. The question is how it works. And all I'm saying is that nowhere else in America do we say that I have to be satisfied that it won't mess up the structure before you allow the most essential employees to be able to bargain for their living. Yes, it will complicate things. Yes, universities might have to decide whether or not to shut down volleyball and what they're going to do and how much are they going to redirect money from the coaching structure or the latest $200 million improvement to the football stadium if they have to pay the players. And how is that going to occur? To me, the model would be the Olympics, where the Olympic committees have votes from all of the athletes, and the Olympics work fine. People thought the Olympics were going to fall apart if they ever paid the athletes, because it was more purely amateur even than college sports. But it hasn't, because athletes are at the table when they decide these questions. They should be at the table at colleges and universities when they face the really difficult question of how are we going to structure these sports? How are we going to have them all? How are they going to work? But we're not even having that discussion or that honest debate on campuses now, because we're pretending that the problem in college sports are dirty athletes. The athletes aren't dirty. The system is dirty.
Let me ask you this finally, both of you, and Seth Davis, I'll put this to you first, because this is another area where you don't seem to agree, you two. Is this movement to change things gaining momentum? Seth Davis, you say, well, only in the media.
Well, let me first say that I very much agree with Taylor Branch about this issue of representation of the athletes and their bargaining power. I think there are a lot of areas, the way that the system is structured, where they don't have enough of a voice, and I would love to have an extended conversation about that. You know, that aside, there is definite movement in terms of getting more to the players to update the scholarship. There is a gap between what it costs to go to school and what the scholarship costs, because the scholarship was basically designed 30, 40 years ago and needs to be updated. So I'm all about having that conversation about how to make that more fair, more equitable, more feasible. But what I'm saying is, if we're going to put this in the realm of compensating athletes as professionals for their athletic abilities, that is never going to happen for a variety of reasons. And I hope, frankly, that it doesn't happen, because I don't want to see the volleyball teams and the lacrosse teams and the baseball teams get eliminated, because I think that those kids are just as important, if not more important, than the Cam Newtons of the world.
Taylor Branch, final word, about a minute left, a little bit less than that.
Well, if the athletes have representation, and I quite frankly think that the non-playing students at campuses should be involved too. These are big enterprises. We're trying to figure out how the intellectual world and the practical world, indeed the obsessional practical world of the market of big-time sports, how they can fit together. That is a great educational enterprise, and we're best to have it. We're better to have it than at universities. Right now, we're not having it because we pretend that this should be somehow amateur. Let's find out if these things can really be reconciled, and let's give honest answers both at the university level and the citizenship level and the player level.
Taylor Branch. His investigation of college sports and the NCAA appears in the October issue of The Atlantic. We have a link, by the way, to his ebook, which explores the issue even in a more full way. Taylor Branch, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Seth Davis, a writer for Sports Illustrated, college basketball analyst for CBS Sports. Thanks very much to you.
My pleasure. And Taylor, great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Seth.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.